Hi, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the TeachNet podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Tina Austin, an AI strategist, educator, and researcher who is helping schools and universities around the world rethink learning in the age of AI. Tina, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Well, it's really great for us to have you. You're joining us from the West Coast of America. It's morning for you. It's evening for us. So maybe you tell everybody, just give them a kind of a high level introduction to your work. You've had a very interesting journey into the world of education, and maybe you might tell us a little bit about your company and the work you're engaged in currently.
Thank you. Yeah. So right now I'm involved in helping educators navigate generative AI responsibly. My background's a little bit unconventional. It came through AI. It actually didn't start with AI. It started with science and being a researcher in the UK. And then I moved here and started teaching developmental biology and stem cells communication. And over the last few years, I've become more increasingly interested in a question that how do educators really navigate AI responsibly and how do they do it in a way that's helpful? I don't know if you want me to give you the background of my journey, but yes.
Yeah, go for it. I mean, I think the way you've come in and your you know, I'm seeing this with a lot of people now in the area of AI and education. They're coming in from legal backgrounds, philosophy backgrounds. You're coming from the STEM side. And again, I think the way that from your own practice when you were teaching and how that brought you into this world of AI, I suppose K-12 and beyond, is very interesting for people, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So before all this, it was more like two Venn diagrams, with one with the science and the other with the teaching. And then the third one got added when we introduced AI in the classroom the first week of ChatGPT being launched, but not as a tool to press buttons, more like something to critique in the classroom. But at the same time, there was like some resistance with other faculty in that particular department saying, we may not necessarily want someone talking about AI, which is when the union reached out to me and said, hey, we'd love for you to talk more about AI and love for you to talk about the pros, the cons, and what we need to worry about, surveillance, ethical use, what does that even look like? And then other faculty reached out and said, hey, we'd love to have a copy of your syllabus. We'd love to see how you're actually using it. And schools, other schools, CSUs, they wanted workshops as well for STEM faculty. So that Venn diagram kind of like became a very interesting picture. If you step back and look at it now, I was talking about AI and medicine and AI and ethical use for healthcare, and kind of led me to now do specific workshops for folks in that field, as well as I'm still connected to K-12 and districts through the union, because being part of the CFP, California Federation of Teachers Task Force, and just love now being connected to all these wonderful people, including now yourself.
Well, look, that's fascinating. And I was mentioning to you at the start of this podcast when we were just chatting, that I've done some work here at the European level with the ETUCE, which is the umbrella body for the teacher trade unions. And just curious, that work with the trade unions, how has that evolved? And has it evolved? And, you know, is it helping teachers right across the US at all levels to feel safe and, I suppose, competent in how they use these tools in their teaching with their learners?
Well, that's the goal, ultimately, is to make them feel confident with their teaching and their learners. But I wouldn't say we're quite there yet. It evolved in a way that faculty and teachers were saying, what is this tech? Is it going to be a threat to my job? Is it going to add workload to my, let's say someone's retiring, are they going to have to worry about now learning a new technology? There's a lot of concern. I felt like in the beginning, there was a lot of pushback. And so there was a real gap between the speed of technology and the support the educators were receiving. And so I think after starting those conversations, it led me to develop specific workshops for those faculty where we start off with what AI can't do. Issues like privacy, bias, intellectual property, assessment, we always start with that. And then go to the fun stuff of maybe what you can do. So that's where it kind of evolved. And then being part of the task force, the California AI Task Force, we are involved in writing guidelines for educators all across California. Now, I'd love to talk to you about PD because that's something that comes up a lot. I personally have evolved the way I've done PD from day one because of good feedback. Every time I start a PD, I have all these surveys and I've kind of over time. And that kind of also led to the Unbloom's work, which I don't want to jump into yet. But having that feedback, I'm very much a feedback-oriented person. My classes have always been interactive. AI was not the first thing to disrupt my classes. It was actually the pandemic that kind of made me have to rethink assessment and teaching. And yeah, so that kind of led to me auditing PD as well.
So, I mean, that's really interesting. I mean, just before we move on to the PD, because I'm very interested in that as well, just in terms of the work you did with the unions and at the state level in California, you mentioned guidelines. Can you just give us a sense of where that's at the moment? You know, who was involved in developing the guidelines? What kinds of things are covered? Is it a document? And is there PD associated with the guidelines so that the teachers can actually take these and, you know, activate them or operationalize them in their own practice?
Yeah, so I'm happy to share the document with you. Maybe I should see if I can actually do that. I know it's a recording.
No, don't worry. We can put it in the show notes. We'll put it in the show notes and people can find it. Don't worry about that.
Yeah. Okay, yes. So it is actually across different representatives, different stakeholders. We have faculty representatives, administrators. We talk about all these issues that we just discussed with what teachers need to know, what do they need to, what tools may or may not do, what they can't do, where the conversation becomes helpful. And so we can't enforce this, right? We can't say that every class has to now follow these guidelines, but it is involved in, you know, building, and we're still working on this document. I don't know the exact number of educators that are on this task force with me. I want to say maybe it's around about 100 all over California. But in many ways, the conversation's moved from just drafting a perfect policy and more about kind of building capacity for institutions to make thoughtful decisions on where the technology needs to go. And there's been so many interesting conversations throughout.
Well, I think that's really interesting. And I think that's very hopeful, actually, for us here in Ireland. And I might come back to this at the end of the podcast, because we just developed, our Department of Education just developed some guidelines late last year, but they admitted that these guidelines, you know, they're going to change. So, but I'm struck by another comment you made there on the PD. You said that, you know, the feedback, but when you started, your PD took a different format. Can you just briefly tell us how your PD has evolved and what's different now from what you started doing initially?
Yeah. So initially, like, I would start with what I was excited about with AI. And I remember my first talk or my first PD for the union. It was very well received by people that knew me, but people that were new to the room and worried about AI wanted me to start with their concerns first. So I realized this is where I need to start every conversation first, is what is the concern of the people in this room before we can even talk about anything else, not what I'm excited about or what I think is the best, you know, diagnostic approach to this. And so then I had three different decks of slides. One was specific for people that are really nervous, and rightfully so. I mean, there's definitely a lot of concerns with AI. We talk about cognitive offloading. We talk about our students actually learning. And then there's the labor that's invisible that educators do anyway. And initially, I think AI was marketed very much as a time-saving tool to educators. If you recall, early days of 2023, 2024, it was more about save time in your classes. And we all know that educators aren't really in this business to save time. I mean, most of us, it's just something we love doing. And if AI saves 1 hour, we end up filling that 1 hour with more time doing other things for our students. So I think that's when I started really revamping all of this to what is the most important concern in the room. And it's never usually about the tech companies or what the tech companies try and tell you to press a button and do. And so I don't do tool talks. I don't do AI evangelism. And I've written actually about this on my Substack, the 7 sins of workshop presenters in AI. And one of them is people that come in talking about tools, because tools change every week. Or people that come in talking about right-click this. People that come in talking about, they just talk about so many negative things, for example. And it becomes such a negative experience that it ends up actually making people feel the opposite at the end of the day. So either they come in extremely hyping this up and it leaves people very skeptical, or they come in extremely skeptical and it makes people wonder, like, why did they even attend this workshop? So,
yeah, I mean, I think we've all experienced all this. And I would actually say that we are still getting the marketing in this part of the world. The marketing is still very, very prolific. And again, a lot of the use cases we're hearing at the moment are predominantly on the efficiency side. Saving time. I'm doing some research at the moment where we're gathering data from educators in the K-12 space. And, you know, it's very much on that, you know, saving time. And when I was teaching, that wasn't my number one concern. It was, is it effective? Is it actually helping them to learn? And I suppose that brings me on to another question that I know you have lots to say on is, do you believe that with the arrival of AI, and particularly, I suppose, it's generative AI tools in the main, in education, that teaching is changing and or that learning is changing? Or is it business as usual? What are you seeing?
I'm seeing in classes that have adopted AI effectively and by my colleagues that are I talk to almost every day about redesigning assessment. I talk a lot about redesigning assessment and who's actually done this in their class. So when we discuss that, we really see this is actually making it more effective, or this is adding something to the picture that we didn't know. For me, one of my early use cases was finding the missing lecture. I would talk about, you know, using stem cells to do this particular regenerative medicine topic. And then my next lecture was about something that was maybe two steps ahead. And the AI would suggest maybe you should have a lecture here about bringing back those extinct species. And I thought that's such a great idea. I should actually have one about bringing back extinct species. And that de-extinction lecture became very popular with the students. And I hadn't thought about adding that to my course, which I developed kind of organically over the years with the advances in stem cells. So then that was just one use case. Another use case was, for example, if someone used the bots, they were going to get a particular answer. I had a custom GPT that would tell them, for this class, we want you to learn this particular thing. So students liked the fact that the bot was kind of helping them with the class. But we would always, always emphasize the weaknesses of these bots. It was never, here's the magical bot, let's just use this bot for answering our questions. So those were just organic things that developed over time. And then agents came along. And so last year I presented at ASUGSV this talk about when to use agents, when to use custom bots, when to use actual chat bots. And what I realized is not many of the AI companies themselves have actually tested this out. So we were experimenting, and being an early adopter, you get to do these things. And then AI companies like, hey, can we put this on our website, or can we use this as well? Which I was happy to do. My bigger concern or question was, is AI actually making learners more capable over time? That was my question. Are they becoming better thinkers over time? Are they actually learning things in a better way? And this is something that's still unresolved. Every week on LinkedIn, I'm deconstructing new research papers on cognitive offloading and metacognition, which I love talking about. But I'm seeing that the research is still very fragmented. It's still very, yeah.
I just wanted to just cut in there because I had a discussion this morning. I'm involved in three European projects at the moment on generative AI. One is the AIDL project. We have 7 countries from across Europe, and the other project, which is a similar number of partners, is called GenAI for Schools. Okay. And I have another one, which is called GenAI for Vet. But anyway, there's a lot of similarities across the three of them. But anyway, the question this morning was effective uses of GenAI. Now, you've just spoken about that there in the last couple of minutes. And we had this big discussion this morning about what is it? What actually, we use these terms like appropriate use of GenAI or effective use of a GenAI. And it seems you've been doing some thinking about this. What does that actually look like? Because, you know, you may be familiar, there's an old model, it's called the SAMR model. At the lowest level, you know, it's just substitution. I mean, it's just doing the same thing we did with a book when we use computers. So I'm just curious, in your work, are you seeing any examples of where the use of these tools, particularly the generative AI tools, is actually effective? And what does that mean? And what does it look like?
Absolutely. So I would say, and I know you and I were talking earlier about Unblooms and what that means, what's that done for my trajectory and learning about tools is, I guess, learning to critique tools initially. So we talk about work with AI, against AI, around AI. First, we start with students drafting the first outline without AI. And then if you want, I mean, this is just one way to do it. This is not one, like, the only way to do it. a pre-AI, before the loop before the loop or pause before the loop, then think about how you would answer. Then you can compare it to an AI's answer. Either your answer was better, or why do you think the AI's answer was better? And in what way, like, are you noticing the biases and the issues that are inherent to AI? So part of this Unbloom's framework is really leaning into knowing where the human can have an advantage over AI. AI is always going to have hallucinations. AI is always going to have biases. We all have biases, but AI also has the biases of whoever the developers, whatever they put in there, they trained the model's data on. And other inherent issues with AI, for example, you know, sticky memory or issues that, you know, I see this on LinkedIn all the time. Someone says, just tell your AI not to be biased, or tell your AI not to do this. Those never work, right? Because it's like telling it what it's inherent it has already to not do, and it doesn't make sense. It's, you can't really advise it that, unfortunately. And so when students become aware of that, for example, I gave them this podcast, they listened to this podcast, it was Google Notebook LM, students immediately picked up not just the lecture, but also the biases that crept into the lecture, the things that the professor never discussed, and, you know, when it was going on a tangent. So that's, I would say, an effective use in the way that every student who did that test or tried that assignment came back and told me they not only understood the lecture, but they also found that they were better than AI in many ways.
And you've introduced it there a couple of times. You've mentioned it. So you've gone to the trouble of developing a framework, and you've also got a workbook. You've called it Unblooms. So will you tell us a little bit about what Unblooms is about, where it came from, what was the inspiration for it, and how it works? And again, we'll share links to more information on it in the show notes. Really interesting tool, I think.
So the idea came from a question that kept bothering me as an educator. As generative AI becomes more capable, we really need to rethink the way we've been learning and teaching. And for decades, Bloom's taxonomy has been really useful for thinking about educational objectives. But Bloom's was developed in a world where access to information was fundamentally different from what we have today. Now, a student can ask an AI to summarize, explain, compare, analyze, even create the top of the Bloom's pyramid. But first of all, Bloom himself never said it was a pyramid. And, you know, what was considered higher order thinking before may not, an AI can already do that. So that led me to focus less on the product and more on the process, and less on what was produced and more how the learner engaged with it. So Unblooms is really an attempt to explore the metacognitive side of learning in an AI-mediated world. It also asks questions like, did the learner exercise judgment? Did they verify the information? Did they reflect on the quality of their response? Did they know when to trust the AI and when to challenge it? Did they remain cognitively engaged throughout the process? So the work grew out of that idea rather than, you know, teaching people how to use a particular tool. And so the UN came from like undoing everything you knew before and kind of like putting it all together. And at first it wasn't a circle. I thought, okay, maybe that's like one of those artistic staircases that goes back and then it goes around. And then I realized, okay, this is just going to be a circle. This has to be a circle. So then the loop was something I drew and presented last year at Oxford. And then, you know, I spoke to folks in Scotland. They said, well, maybe it's also a spiral, and introduced the discernment spiral. And so it's kind of like evolved. So if you're using that old chatbot, now it's kind of evolved a little bit more to like having the discernment spiral and how to measure it and lots of interesting things that are coming up.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I mean, at the heart of the framework, which I think in my language, it's really a tool to think with. And I think the workbook, because I've had a look at some of the free pages that are on Amazon, you know, it's question-based. It's actually giving you as an educator some, let's call it scaffolding questions that you could get your students to engage with in your class. And you could adapt it, I'm sure, as well for your own context. But when you were thinking and putting, you know, you've put problems at the center, what are the kinds of problems that people are coming at? You know, what are the typical problems that people are coming with?
Yes, and I love that you mentioned it, because I almost forgot to mention the whole idea with Unblooms is asking, what is the problem you're trying to solve? And I think a lot of us forget about this. And when I write about it on Substack, people saying this makes so much sense. But no, we're trying to give people, instead of giving them answers, have them ask better questions. And what is it in K through 12? What is it in your class that you want to solve? And so someone might say, well, I just want them to learn the history of this in a way that they can understand the difference between X and Y. So if that's the different thing you want to solve, you can enter that loop at any point, as long as you're kind of, the idea of the loop was also because learning is recursive, it's not linear. Whereas the original Bloom's taxonomy kind of is going up the ladder. And my colleague suggested, well, maybe we flip Bloom's in an inverted pyramid and you're still doing that hierarchy thing. Whereas I felt learning is recursive. Sometimes you reiterate, you go back and you revise. And so that was where that came from. And then the core of it is problem solving. And AI is in the outline. It doesn't need to be in every assignment. It doesn't need to be in every class. So that's something I emphasize a lot, is people saying, is this just like teaching with AI or learning with AI? Sure, but AI is not necessarily part of every assignment we teach. And
no, and I think that's really interesting as well. And again, something we chatted about at the outset. You know, this idea, and it's not a new idea, and we can do it without AI as well, is critical thinking. And I know it's something that you've mentioned, and recently when you were on the AI and Education podcast with our friends down in Australia, you talked about this. So for you, what does being critical in the age of AI mean? What are some of the key messages that you share with educators and with learners when they are, you know, thinking critically about these tools?
Yes, I love that, because it's also another term that's been thrown around a lot. It's kind of like confetti. Everybody's like, oh, let's do more critical thinking, or let's have more critical thinking. But what does that really mean? It's not about prompting. It's not about, you know, necessarily following step by step. But I think critical thinking is more an act of resistance. We have like level 5 of Bloom's on Bloom's now with like, when should AI not be used at all? And it's not productive to even have AI. It goes against like misinformation. And I guess it used to mean analyzing information, but now it's more like knowing when the information is wrong, even when it sounds completely right, and really knowing when to push back. And that's why we have this decision tree in the workbook, which actually is just the first of the series. Many people have said, hey, can we have this unblooms for hiring managers? Can we have unblooms for marketing people? So that's just the workbook, which is just like instructional design version. I'm really thinking of expanding this more into like what critical thinking looks like for someone that's, you know, an administrator. So schools are, you know, unfortunately, you know, sometimes they're buying tools before they handle, they're building understanding. Sometimes they send teachers to one-off workshops and they think, okay, they're AI trained. Or they treat AI adoption as it's like this IT decision, and or bottom up or top down. And no one's really asking, where does AI support the learning? Where does it interfere with it? So all of that can be part of critical thinking. But I mean, I can go on and talk to you about formulas and discernment rate, which is something.
No, but I think, and the other word that you used last time out, and it was something that we've used with another colleague of mine, Dr. Deirdre Butler, it's about being skeptical. You know, yes. We need to be skeptical, and skeptical doesn't mean you're negative. It just means you're questioning, you're querying, you're not taking these, you know, slogans, marketing, you're not taking the content. You're actually critically looking at this in a way that you're looking, making an informed decision. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. You're right. I mentioned this last time about being skeptical. We need to be skeptical, you know, but we also need to be in the world that we're in right now, which the tech exists. If some people will say, let's just ban it and that'll solve our problems, but we still need to be in this world where people are using technology, but we just need to be very skeptical about it. Skeptical and also kind of willing to see what the other side is trying to say.
Yeah, but one of, and we're coming near the end because as we said at the outset, we knew our time would fly. But I think in your work, you very much unpack this idea of critical. You know, you talk about when to use it, when not to use it. You talk about what tools, you know, it's a bit like a carpenter. What tool do you use for what task? You don't just use, you know, the old adage, you don't use a sledgehammer to crack a nut. How do you use these tools? What are the processes? What are the ways to use them? And then we have the output. So, I mean, you talked about the decision tree. You know, I mean, you're trying to give people a set of tools that'll help them to make better decisions. That's my view. Is that what you're trying to do?
Yes, absolutely. Because we do, like I said, minus AI, plus AI, times AI, around AI. And so again, the decision tree, do we care about the output being accurate? If high accuracy is important, we're not going to use AI. if it's about something creative, that's just like several ideas out there, sure, we can use AI. There's several more. I don't have it memorized off the top of my head, but it's all in there and it's evolving. And the goal is to kind of build judgment in the students, build discernment in the students. And those two are also different things. Judgment and then discernment has a little bit more nuance there. So going beyond just using AI as a brainstorming tool, but also kind of adding more things to learning that maybe we couldn't do before AI. And in many ways, I'm optimistic. And in many ways, I still think everyone should still remain skeptical about completely accepting everything that is marketed out there.
Yeah, but I mean, we are humans at the end of the day. And you talk a lot about the humans and about our decision-making processes. And we are ultimately dealing with a machine. So we have certain advantages as humans. But just to finish, if you were advising the Irish Department of Education today, what is the biggest mistake that schools are making with AI and what should they do instead? And just to be clear, that question was developed by your own chatbot on Bloomit. So maybe you could tell us a bit about that and your answer at the same time.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest mistakes, and there's many mistakes, is primarily treating AI primarily as a technology problem than a learning problem. And when we do that, we end up focusing on the tools, maybe the policies, the platforms, and the latest feature, but they're not the most important questions. Instead, I think the more important question is, what kind of thinkers are we trying to develop? What kind of human capabilities do they value? What does good judgment look like? How do they make decisions, solve problems? How do they reflect on their own thinking? Because nowadays, students not only have to manage their own cognition, but also deal with a model that has its other cognition. So they have to monitor that cognition too. When we talk about metacognition, there's both. So the technology is going to keep changing and the model is going to be changing. So students also need to get the basic judgment or our frameworks to be able to understand that 6 months from now, they should still be able to have those skills, when to resist, when to do something with it that would be helpful. And those tools will come and go. So I think the need for discernment, critical thinking, curiosity, ethical reasoning, metacognition isn't going away. And in fact, it's a topic that we're very much in conversation with. And I think these capabilities are becoming more and more important in an AI world where everybody has access to these tools. So how do you differentiate yourself in the job market if you're in advising the Department of Education? Instead of asking, how do we get AI into schools, I would focus on asking, how do we prepare students to think well in a world where AI exists?
Well, I think that's a fantastic answer. And I think it's a great place to finish. And I really want to thank you for giving of your time today and for being so generous. We will put links to all your materials in the show notes, but a big, I'll say it in Irish, Gura Míle maith agat, and we're really thankful to you for your time today, Tina.
Thank you so much again, Michael, for inviting me. And I look forward to visiting Ireland sometime soon as well. It's always been on my list.